Hey, welcome to the Chess Experience. On this show, it's all about helping adult improvers. I want to make learning chess easier for you to navigate, and I also want you to have a more fun experience along the way. I'm your host, Daniel Lona, a fellow chess amateur. Let's get to it. This show is sponsored by Chess.com, the world's largest chess community. Chess.com recently launched a new way to learn from your games with a feature called Insights. If you visit chess.com/insights, you can get detailed stats and analysis in any of the time controls you've played and across any time period. What kind of things can you learn? Well, you can learn what time of day do you play your best, morning, afternoon, or night? What part of the game are you strongest or weakest? Opening, middle game, or end game? Are you making more or less mistakes than opponents at your level? You can find out all this great info and much more at chess.com/insights. Welcome to this week's show. If you've ever wondered what to look for in a chess coach or how to get the most out of the experience, this is your episode. To help explore this topic, I chat with international master Yuri Krikun. Yuri has been a repeat and popular guest on this show before, but if you're not familiar with him, he's a prolific and highly regarded course creator with Chessable, focusing mainly on opening courses. Yuri has also been coaching students of all levels for some years now and has had tons of experience with adult improvers. I've even had some coaching with Yuri, and he's absolutely fantastic. For those reasons, I felt he was a perfect fit to discuss the subject of chess coaching for this episode. One small insight I had after the interview is that there's some really good discussion on improvement in general in this episode, regardless of whether you're working with a coach or even want to work with a coach. So even if you're not interested in getting a coach anytime soon or even ever, I still think you can get some good stuff out of this episode. But overall, in our discussion, we cover some key points like, what are some of the qualities you should look for in a chess coach? Do you even need to work towards a specific goal with your coach? What are some of the traits of Yuri's most successful students? And of course, how can you get the most out of your coaching experience? Here's my interview with Yuri. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Yuri. It's great to have you back on the podcast. How are you doing?
Hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for having me again. I'm doing great. The weather is lovely. It's 70 degrees outside in February, so nothing to complain about.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you back on the show. You know, for longtime listeners, they'll know that this will be your third appearance on the show. Your episodes are amongst the most popular that I've recorded, so people love your advice. And you were there for this show in the very beginning, and so I'm excited to have you back a third time, Yuri, to just keep helping people with their chess.
Well, absolutely. The podcast has grown a lot. Hopefully, we can make it grow further. And I can't wait to discuss some new things today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we got a big topic here in the sense of one that's very relatable regardless of skill level. And also, it's probably, you know, I get asked a lot of questions that, frankly, half the time I'm not qualified for, but probably in the top two or three questions in terms of frequency that I get asked is, how should I choose a coach? And so I'm excited to talk about this issue kind of at length with you, Yuri, because I think it's a big one. It's an important one. Even people who don't have a coach often think about whether to get one. And even people who already have a coach who are listening to this, I think can find this useful because, you know, people aren't always satisfied with the coach that they have, or maybe they just want to try somebody different. So I think whichever camp someone might be in, I think this will be really helpful for people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the topic is really important. And generally speaking, of course, well, you could argue I'm biased, but I love talking about learning things and how to learn things in the most efficient way because our time is limited, right?
Right.
Time on earth and time for leisure, you know, all kinds of hobbies. So I think optimizing it is super important. So yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah. Let's dive into kind of like just framing the subject before we get into like the ins and outs of working with a coach. I just thought we could start with the question of, you know, what are some of the most compelling reasons to get a coach? And it's kind of funny that I'm asking you this question right now because I think it was just 2 days ago, maybe even less than just 1 day ago, that this topic came up on Twitter and you discussed it. And I thought you had some great points about why someone should even consider getting a coach. If they're not quite sold on the idea yet, or maybe don't even fully appreciate how much value one can provide. So yeah, maybe you can just start with that. Like, what are the most compelling reasons to get a coach?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think for one, we live in a very new, very unusual time. In a sense that, you know, I'm 25, so I'm not that old, but when I started playing chess, you know, we would all go to the chess club and even the little kids would be taught by someone, right? And that's, I think, how, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, most activities were, right? You wanted to learn something, you'd go into a place where people practice it and people do it, and then you'd learn from them, right? And now we're in the time where you could just open the internet and learn whatever you want, right? From YouTube or, you know, online articles or any other sources. Yeah. So I think, first of all, you know, the idea of self-learning obviously is not new. You could always read a book, right? And self-learning is super important. But the idea that it would be so pronounced that you'd be doing something without a community of like-minded people or without some guidance is, I think, pretty new in chess, at least, you know? And in a sense, it's great, not to deviate too far, right? But, you know, back 50 years ago, if you were from a country with no chess tradition, you were doomed. And now you have an opportunity, right? But generally speaking, I think it's a no-brainer that if you want to learn something, while, of course, you could get quite far on your own, why not just follow the path of someone who's already done it? And why not shorten the span that it takes to get there by, you know, not repeating some of the mistakes, right? And just doing the optimal thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. A large part of what you're saying, Yuri, is like this concept of time or speed. I guess they're kind of like two sides of the same coin in this discussion, which is that coaching saves you time by not having to reinvent the wheel. And, you know, what that ultimately means is that you also get to your goal faster than you would have if you were doing it on your own. Is that a fair way to summarize it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, like it or not, right, there's a fairly limited amount of time, right, to realize your potential if you're talking about high-level accomplishments, right? Because, of course, one thing is if you're, you know, 40 years old, you're doing something for fun, right? And you feel like, hey, I've got my entire lifetime to, you know, see how far I can go. You know, that's one story. But let's say if you're 6 years old or 10 years old, right, and you want to get somewhere, you know, to the professional level, right, by the time you're, let's say, a teenager or a young adult, right, then, well, the moment the time passes, you no longer have it, you know, so you'd better see how far and how fast you can go right away, right? There's no time to lose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think the subject of motivation is an important one. I feel like having that coach that you are going to check in with, even if it's just, say, like a very... I would guess, you know, in the scheme of how often you can get coaching, a limited amount, if it were even just once a month, that you'll probably end up being far more motivated to do the studying and hard work that chess requires if you know you have to check in with a coach. If you don't have to check in with a coach, this is something I noticed for me, especially like playing classical games, because it's hard to schedule those. It's difficult for adults, that I was just much more likely to do a weekly classical game because I had to give one to my coach to review. And I think in the absence of that, you might just do a lot less for your chess, which, you know, is fine. But if you actually do want to make regular improvement, it's not so great if you're not consistently working on it.
Yeah, I think that's true without a doubt as well. I think having some kind of responsibility, right? It could be in front of your friends too, to be fair, you know, but yeah, if you have a mentor, you know, that you respect and you like, and you feel that there's a certain responsibility, I think that definitely can boost the effort you put in. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I think those are a few good reasons as to why someone should consider coaching. I think for the most part, though, we don't need to dive a whole lot into that because I'm guessing people are clicking on this episode and how to choose a coach. They're probably already sold on its value. So let's dive into like actually how you do that and what factors to consider and how to make the most of your coaching. So let's start with that. Someone's already, you know, kind of past the point that we just addressed, they realize the value of a chess coach, but they're a little unclear on just what factors they should consider. I guess maybe a better word is criteria. Like, what criteria are good to consider when choosing a coach?
So yeah, I think one of the most important factors in being able to teach successfully and convey any kind of, you know, wisdom and knowledge is your ability to relate to the student and your ability to communicate with them, right? So I think the most important thing really is the person good at communicating? And, well, partially, I guess, if you already follow them, for example, through Chessable courses or YouTube, you could probably already have a good idea, right? If you like the way someone presents, well, there's a decent chance that you would probably like the way they explain things to you. But of course, I think it's super helpful to see if the coach has relevant experience, right? Because I think there's a big difference between, for example, a grandmaster helping an international master level player, right, become a grandmaster versus, for example, a coach for children helping, you know, beginner kids, right, fall in love with chess and learn some basic things. And they all could be amazing at what they do, right? But maybe you can do some of this and not all of this, right? There are also coaches who are able to teach a pretty broad range of players, right? So I think you want to look at the experience, you want to look at the ways they communicate, but also I think what's super important, you want to see how you click with the person, right? Maybe you have some, you know, sympathy, right, so to speak, and, you know, connection on a personal level, you like them, right? And maybe you don't. I think that's also an important factor. It's not a hard, you know, measurement, right? It's just something that either happens or doesn't, I think, right? So I think it's totally okay to give it a shot with a coach. And if something doesn't work out, maybe try another one.
Yeah, all great advice. You brought up an interesting point about different levels of skill within the coach, him or herself. Yeah, because I was thinking, you know, a lot of my listeners typically fall in the range of being adult club players. So, you know, they're past the absolute beginner stage where they just learned how the pieces move. But the vast majority of people listening are not title players or, you know, even 2000. With that in mind, if they're kind of in that range of, say, more closer to like 1000 to 1900, can it be overkill for them to choose like a grandmaster as a coach? That, I mean, I'm just wondering if that matters much. Like if a national master or an IM might just be a bit closer in terms of just kind of understanding that mindset of a club player a little bit easier. I don't know. Does that matter much or should that not even factor into who they choose?
You know, it's interesting. I think the level is not that important, actually. Also, I'll go into a bit more detail on that in a moment. But in my experience, what's interesting is I've noticed some of the best coaches I've met are not the brightest child prodigies themselves. A lot of them started playing chess, not let's say at 4, you know, or 5 years old, but at maybe 10 or 12 and made it there a little bit later, which maybe allowed them to kind of remember better how they could, you know, what process they were going through themselves, you know. Because, for example, I have a lot of friends who are incredibly talented, right, who are already master level players by age 11, right? And I think that could make it a little harder for them to understand what exactly is required, right, to improve as an adult. Although not impossible by any means. But I do want to say that I think a lot of players have this somewhat odd, you know, belief that if you're taking lessons from someone who is not a grandmaster or an international master, they're bad at chess or they're not teaching you right, you know. I've read a lot of comments like, you know, if you're taking lessons from a FIDE master, they likely don't understand chess very well and, you know, themselves, or they'll teach you wrong, you know. And really, I mean, this is, of course, absolute nonsense. You know, I just think in most cases, you want the strength difference to be there, 400, 500, 600 points, you know, but, you know, it's important to understand, right? I mean, FIDE master in chess, you know, is like PhD in any, you know, for example, science, right? It takes tremendous effort to get there. And yes, a PhD, you know, holder, if they're decent at communicating, can teach a first grade student, you know, or, you know, a high schooler, you know, at all times. I mean, there's not a lack of knowledge. You don't have to be a, you know, Nobel Prize winner, right, to do it successfully.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. Plus, I think a lot of, you know, at least half of what you're doing as a coach is, like you said, the ability to communicate and the ability to teach, which, you know, is far more important than, I think, whatever would be learned between FIDE master or IM to the GM level, right?
Yeah, you know, it's actually interesting. Also, at some point, I was taking lessons with a 2600 player who was very good. I happened to become friends with someone rated about 2450, and I was maybe 2350 myself trying to become an international master. And then we started working together with this guy, 2450. He was a coach. He was coaching full time and asked if he can coach me. And actually, it helped me tremendously because what happened is we played a lot of tournaments together and he literally played the exact same people that I did, you know, and I needed a bit of a boost to become an international master. And he could relate much better to what problems I was dealing with and who I was facing, you know, rather than a 2600 grandmaster who was only playing other top, you know, world's top 100 GMs in some leagues or close tournaments. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. I like that. So once you've selected a coach, there's a handful of questions that I had for you at that point. First, do you recommend like having kind of a trial period, even if it's unofficially? Like maybe you don't necessarily have to say that to the coach you've hired or anything, or maybe they just offer one. I don't know. But and when I say trial period, I just mean a brief amount of sessions. Maybe it's one lesson, maybe it's two or three, that you just kind of take that time to decide whether it's a good fit. Is that a practice that you recommend? Is it something to look for in, you know, potential coaches?
Yeah, I think there's literally zero downside to doing that, right? You give it a shot for a couple lessons and you see if you click, if you like the person, if everything goes well, and then you want to see if it, whether to proceed or not, right? I mean, to be fair, you know, of all the students I taught in the last years, maybe, I don't know, like in 100 people, maybe one didn't continue, you know? So I'm not sure how exactly important it is, because I've been kind of on the good end of this experience.
Right.
Also, I guess on the other end, you know, but I think, you know, there is no need to commit to anything for half a year, right? If you don't know if that would work for you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Are there any, I guess for lack of a better phrase, warning signs a student should look for that might tell them they don't have a coach that's a good fit? And when I say that, I don't necessarily mean that you have a bad coach per se. It could just be that, as we alluded to, you're not clicking or something like that. But I just want to get specific into what that would be. Like, how would you know that maybe this isn't the best coach for you?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a bit of a weird thing to say, right? I mean, I recently found out, you know, a few students shared with me that, for example, they tried, you know, taking lessons with someone. And then he said, well, we had 7 lessons or something. And out of 7, the coach overslept 5 of them.
Oh, no.
You know, and I just don't know how common it is because, well, to me, punctuality is very important. That's what I think people should expect of me. And that's what I expect of my students, to be honest. I don't expect people to be, you know, 5 or 10 minutes late regularly, for example.
Right.
Right. And unless something happens, I think it's unacceptable to be late anywhere, whether it's, you know, a barbershop or, I don't know, doctor's appointment or anything, right? But to be honest, I think one of the things chess struggles with a little bit, right, is that most chess players are kind of used to full autonomy, so to speak. They do things on their own schedule. So maybe, I don't know, it's just common in the chess coaching world to, for example, not, you know, be too professional, I guess. But, you know, me personally, I've had nothing but good experience while taking lessons, right? And most of my friends, I think, are very professional and punctual. So it's a little bit funny rather than actually a serious warning. But obviously, on a serious note, you need to understand whether, for example, the expectations align, right? For example, whether you can schedule lessons easily or move them easily, or whether there's some, you know, rigid schedule, right? Whether there's an understanding that you schedule things and then you don't cancel them, right? Which maybe busier coaches are expecting, or whether the coach gives you home assignments if you're looking for that, or whether they're able to communicate with you outside of lessons, right? You ask a question and then does it get answered or does it get ignored, right? And things of that sort, I think, mostly, right? And not all everyone's expecting that, right? I have a lot of students who are super serious, but I have a lot of students who are just doing it for fun and who, let's say, just bluntly say, hey, I don't have any time ready for home assignments. I'll just play some chess until I see you next time, you know? And that's fine. But I think what's important is just to make sure that there is a, you know, compatibility, so to speak.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, professionalism, compatibility, expectations. I think those are all great things to kind of look for in terms of being aligned. In fact, I was going to ask this a little later in the interview on the subject of expectations, but since you brought it up, I think now is a good time to kind of continue that discussion, because I think expectations are a key part of that coaching relationship and finding, you know, just a coaching experience that works both for the coach and the student. I guess in particular, I would like to talk about expectations as it relates to progress, because that's, I think, one of the biggest areas that topic can come up. So, you know, I know there's probably a lot of, I don't know exactly how to phrase it. There's just a lot of maybe just wrong expectations for whatever reason about how quickly a person can progress in chess, particularly, I think, at the club level. You know, usually in the sense of expecting a lot more results faster than they actually come. So what kind of progress expectations should a student have with their coach?
Well, you know, one of my favorite things to recommend, although I think it is important to have goals and ambitions and want to get better, you totally should. But in my experience, what tends to work unbelievably well is setting expectations that are guaranteed to be met, right? If you put in the effort. So if we say, hey, in half a year from now, we need to have solved a few thousand puzzles and we need to have finished 3 books and you need to play 100 games and analyze each of them, right? Well, that's on the student. Maybe they're too busy to do that, and maybe we can arrange some other kind of expectations, right? But that clearly can be done 100%. Now, if you say, hey, you need your rating to be 140 points higher, you know, in 6 months, would that happen? Who knows, right? There is no way to guarantee it, right? Especially if we're talking over the board, right? Maybe he had one bad tournament. Now what? But if you have a workload ahead of you, and if you both think that this is a reasonable workload, right? So you don't do too little and you're also not overwhelmed, right? Being asked too much of, and you complete it successfully, then it's nearly impossible to not get better. Now, obviously, when you're talking about professional players, right? It's not easy for a title player to get considerably better fast, right? And there could be stagnation. But if you're rated 1500 and I tell you, hey, you need to read this 4 books, and by read it, I mean, not glance over them, right? But actually go through every example, take your time. And then the student really diligently does that, then there's no way they don't get better, you know, statistically.
Yeah. All great points. Yeah, because I think this is a big one for a lot of people. I mean, even whether they have a coach or not, right? Like, it just seems like a lot of people get frustrated with their pace of progress. I mean, obviously, the first go-to troubleshoot if someone's not making the progress at the pace that they hoped for is, you know, like you alluded to, are you doing the work that it takes to get there? I mean, if that's true whether you have a coach or not, you got to ask that question. But in an instance where a student does seem to be at least mostly on top of the work that you would expect of them to do, it's been some months and they're not fully satisfied with their progress. Either they haven't made any, or they've made some, but it's not quite as fast as they wanted. And they're doing the work. What do you say to a student in that instance?
Well, there's a couple of things to check, I think. So number one, do you play enough or not, right? Because if you play, let's say, 100 games a year, I think it's very clear if your results are going up or not, right? But if you play, let's say, 20, honestly, who knows, right? Let's say you could score 10 points out of 20, right, before, and then you work hard for a year. Now you should be able to score 12, for example, right? But the sample size is so small that it's literally just a matter of one or two good moves, right? So number one, do you play enough? I have a lot of students who are very interested in studying chess. Maybe I shouldn't say a lot because actually that's a minority, but there are still such people super interested in studying chess. They play very little. They just like studying, you know. In those cases, it's a little tricky to track their progress and always try to get them out there in the real world, right? And say, hey, I know you know so much now. Now go prove it, right? That's number one. Number two, make sure if the non-chess factors are aligned, right? Because number one, right? Is your sleep routine good, right? Are you playing tournaments? Some of my students play, you know, night tournament at 8 p.m. after coming back there after a stressful day at work, right? Typically doesn't work out very well, yeah? Or some people play chess online at 11 p.m., you know, after doing things all day. I say, hey, why don't you just go to bed and play in the morning instead, right? These things are really simple, but often can make a big difference because your rating is literally just the average of your performance, right? It could be your rating is, let's say, 1600. It likely means you could play as an 1800 on good days and as a 1400 on bad days, yeah? But if all of your days are bad, you know, then obviously the performance is getting dragged down, right?
Right.
So that's important. And then I guess, you know, in terms of measuring actual progress outside of these factors, here is what I would say. Sometimes they're ready to make a big jump. They're ripe for a big jump in their results, or sometimes actually it's the opposite. Sometimes I think progress or rating gains are happening a little too fast and are not very well deserved. Well, not deserved rather, but I think could make things look better than they do. And here's what I mean. So let's just say, you know, you put a lot of effort into reading 2 books on Endgame. And so supposedly something good should happen, right? Your result should increase. But what happens if a lot of your games just literally don't get to an endgame? Then I understand you've done the work, but obviously there's no way to tell its impact. You know, I have a funny story myself. I was struggling against a move 1e4 when I was already at a master level. So I learned e4, e5 for black. And then guess what? For half a year, not a single person played 1e4 against me. 6 or 7 tournaments straight, like 30 games, not a single person. How likely is it? Very unlikely, but that's what happened, you know? And I was joking, well, the problem with C4 has been solved, right? No one plays it against it anymore.
But, right.
You know, or, I mean, I had the other case too. Like a student would learn some opening line or do something, and then 10 games in a row, they're able to, you know, take advantage of knowing that something, so their results are incredibly high, but I genuinely don't think that that's their strength yet, you know? So it's going a little too well, and that happens too. Now, if you tell someone, hey, you're doing a little too well, you know, you need to be ready for disappointment. Everyone laughs and no one takes it seriously, but I mean, it happens too. You know, if it happens the other way, of course, you know, if it's been long enough, right, it's worth kind of thinking about what's going wrong, right? But a lot of the time, I think it's honestly just a matter of time, a little bit more time. If the work is being done, the results come inevitably.
Yeah, yeah. There's something you said in particular that I'd like to kind of just elaborate a little bit on and get your thoughts on, which is that there can be, I think often in chess, I don't know, I've done several different endeavors in my life, but I feel like with chess, it's more true than others, that there's this lag in progress that you can see, even though you are getting better, accumulating knowledge, accumulating experience, just because chess just seems so huge in its spectrum of scenarios and areas that you can improve at, that they don't always come up all the time. But eventually, as you keep improving different areas, they will start to come up and affect that average that you talked about. So I just want to kind of just quickly address that. Do you see that often as well, that there's this, can be this lag because of that reason, because there's just so many different areas that you can work on, and sometimes they don't always manifest yet in your rating? I guess that's the main question. And if so, like, kind of, I mean, how do you deal with that? I mean, I guess maybe it's just an expectation and awareness, I suppose. Maybe I'm answering your question for you. Sorry about that. But yeah, just kind of get your take on that.
Yeah, absolutely. There is. I think also, one of the things you can do to maybe experience less of a lag, or at least witness and enjoy the results of your work right away, would be the following. So let's say you're reading a book about attacking, right? And most of your games are boring. Well, in a lot of cases, what I think can be done, you shouldn't overdo it necessarily on purpose, but you definitely can kind of juice it up a little bit. You know, let's say there is a position where you can trade queens and have an endgame, or you can sacrifice a piece and have something interesting going on. And it's not clearly bad or clearly terrible, because then it's obvious what to do, but it's just interesting. Well, if you're learning how to attack, do it. Do it and see what happens. Or if you're reading an endgame book and you have an option to keep the middle game on the board or trade queens, right? And try to play what you're practicing. So whatever you're focusing on at the time, be it endgame or positional decision making or whatever else it could be, try getting as much of it in your games as possible, right? Especially if these are training games, because again, frankly, right? Training games, obviously you're trying to do well. No one wants to lose on purpose, but they don't matter really, right?
Right. Yeah, well, that's great advice. That's a great tip. I love it. I guess just kind of one last subtopic within this concept of having expectations with a coach, to me, is the goals that you have and that you're working towards with a coach. I think you said this almost explicitly. You don't always have to have some specific goal that you're working on, even if you've hired a coach. So yeah, just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem, I guess, with having specific goal, right? It's like asking yourself, well, how much money would you like to make, right? The answer is always as much as possible, right? I mean, right. What rating would you like to accomplish, right? Where would you like to get? As high as I can, right? So in a sense, right, you know, you could be humble, right? You could say I'm 1800, I dream of getting to 1900, right? But everyone knows you want to get as far as you can, right? So now the question is, well, what's holding you back? I mean, this is a real question you need to answer. And sometimes there is an easy solution. Sometimes there is not, right? Chess is, you know, a difficult activity, just like many other things. And, you know, I think we enjoy it because it's difficult, it's challenging, it takes work. But if you understand that your attacking skills are horrible, or maybe your defensive skills are horrible, or endgame skills are need work or whatever it is, well, you know, if you want to get better, that's what you need to fix, right? So then the question is, how do you fix that? And by answering this question, you're almost guaranteeing yourself rating progress. You need to solve the problems you have, right? And yeah. I think the same, you know, works in life as well. Maybe you're not doing well in your career because you're not very organized, or maybe you don't deal with people too well, right? Maybe you need to learn a little better how to communicate, or maybe you're impulsive, or maybe you lose motivation and burn out and quit, right? Or whatever that is. I mean, this is what needs to be solved, because asking yourself a question, right? How do I get a promotion or something, right? Or I don't know, like whatever, you know, how much do I want to be promoted in the next 5 years at work, right? I mean, okay, let's dream a little bit. It's great to dream. It's great to have aspirations, right? I'm all for it. I do have them too. But ultimately, the better question is, actionable question is, what's holding me back? How do I make sure that thing gets better, you know?
Right. Yeah, love it. Question regarding openings, because that's an interesting one. I think it's kind of specific to, I mean, there's coaching for a lot of different areas in life that you could have, but I think openings are very, very specific to chess. But it's a big topic and it comes up a lot. I've kind of observed different scenarios, like kind of, you know, as I kind of listen to the chatter, so to speak, on Twitter about what other adults say about their experiences with their coaches. And, you know, that they might say something like, oh, my coach wants me to play XYZ opening. I didn't want to play it, but I'm giving it a shot because they said I should do it. And it's kind of always just intrigued me, this a little bit of a, maybe a push and pull. It depends on the personalities of the coach and student. But how should openings be approached with your coach? Or what do you recommend? Do you recommend that the student just, you know, like if a coach says, play these openings, I think it's good for you, they should just go with that? Or should they have more input in that? How do you see that process?
Well, you know, there's a couple, I think, of opinions here, right? I mean, opinion number one is that, you know, you should do things that suit your style, but when you're starting out, you don't have one, right? Because a person rated 1100, let's say, they're just learning how chess works, and they've probably already seen quite a bit, they've played quite a bit, but they don't really know yet what they like. I can guarantee you, I can take any player rated 1100 and then show them, you know, 20 attacking games and they'll say, man, I love attacking, or show them 20 endgame, you know, examples and they'll say, man, this looks so cool, I love endgames, you know. It's very easy to persuade someone who is new to something to into liking something, you know. So generally speaking, there is no trick here. So if you follow that opinion, right, you could definitely say that, okay, well, let's just do the things that will help you develop certain skills. And then it doesn't really matter what the opening is called. We just, here's a bunch that will help you get there, so you can pick from that list, right? On the other hand, obviously, for stronger players who already have preferences, that's what you would want to go with, right? Just imagine, for example, if you're asking me, hey, you know, I want to move to a new place, where should I go, right? Well, I shouldn't probably tell you Chicago, right, or New York. I should rather ask you, well, what are you looking for? Are you looking for, you know, a big city, or maybe a place with beaches, or warm or cold, or expensive or cheap, or whatever it is? And you would say, you know, I really don't like snow, right? Well, in that case, definitely not Chicago, but there's still 10 options to choose from, you know, maybe Phoenix, maybe LA, maybe Austin, yeah. I don't know, whatever that is, right? Or Miami. So with chess openings, I think most of them can be described somehow sharp or quiet or boring, or I mean, not boring, but positional, right? Or with a lot of theory or very little theory, or positions tend to be, you know, forgiving in terms of mistakes, or, you know, with a very high cost of mistake, right? One bad move you often lose, like Dragon, for example. So if you already have some idea of what you're looking for, then that's, I think, a good place to be, right? For example, we just had a conversation 2 hours ago with a student who said, hey, I don't like this line, so I'm thinking of picking a new one. I'm thinking of picking this. And I asked him, well, how would this help you solve your problem, right? Because it's very similar, you see, in character. And he said, actually, I see that. So what would you recommend? And I said, you know, you have these three options, for example, right? And I can give you some model games or file or whatever it is so you can take a look. But, you know, if your problem is that you don't want the position to get too crazy, then, you know, here's what you have to be picking from. And then also, I think it is generally healthy and good advice, right? If you're a beginner, you play one e4, you get very open positions. It's much easier to learn what is an attack or checkmate than it is to learn what is, you know, a weak pawn or pawn chain or something. Mm. Pretty much useless when you're new to chess, right?
Right.
So yeah. Playing positions where everything is extremely slow and non-specific, and you can choose one of the 8 moves and you don't really know what's going on, is not the fastest way to improve, I think.
Yeah. What do you think are some ways that a student can get the most out of their coaching?
Show up sharp, not tired, with questions. A lot of students who were newer to coaching, what I noticed, they started opening up a lot more in a couple of lessons. And first lessons, they would just, you know, be kind of quieter and just nod and say, you know, yes, I got it, you know. And then they would start asking a lot more questions, which is, of course, a much more helpful way to learn, right? You have to be engaging in this, right? You have to be active. So number one, my only rule is that, you know, there is no stupid questions, right? a lot of my students say, hey, let me ask you a stupid question, right? I mean, that doesn't work, right? You can do that. You're not allowed to say that phrase. Besides that, you can say whatever you want, right? You can repeat, you can come back, you can say, I didn't understand. You can say, can you walk me through this? You can, you know, repeat again, right? The goal is to get all of your questions answered. So it's very important, I think, to kind of help your coach with that in a sense, right? Because I hope everything is clear, but maybe it's not, then ask, right? Or maybe you have some question and I likely have an idea of what kind of questions you have, but maybe you have some other ones, right? So be active, be as active as possible. Push your coach, right? Ask them all the questions you want, right? Don't be passive, right? It's not a video, you know? You need to take advantage of being able to interact with the person as much as possible, right? And then I think, you know, showing up prepared, right? With a list of questions, typically, if you're able to spend a lot of time doing anything, say chess in this case, right? You played it for 10 hours last week and you had a bunch of questions. Well, prepare them, right? You can say, hey, I read this book. I saw this position. The author said that. I don't agree. Can you explain to me why that's right? Or maybe it's not, you know? So oftentimes I think it's not, there's nothing bad necessarily about the idea that the coach prepares a topic and then they discuss it, right? But if a student is very engaged, and that's I think best by far.
Yeah, that's great. So two different points, but both on the subject of questions. Like one is, I think you're saying, right, to ask questions during the coaching lesson instead of just being quiet the whole time, and then the other is to bring questions to the lesson that you have as well. So yeah, I love all that. How about in terms of again, coming back to expectations, do you recommend that a student have like a conversation in the beginning? I mean, hopefully the coach would probably do this, but if they didn't, maybe just the student, you know, asking in the first couple of lessons, like, you know, just saying like, here's what I'm hoping to achieve. Can you do that for me? And just kind of bringing that out into the open right away.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the best way I like to think of it is not, can you do that for me, but can we get this done together, you know, or what can we do together to get there, right? But yeah, absolutely. I think it is just fair to both people to make sure that the expectations are the same in terms of what we are working towards and how much effort does it take to get there. You know, if a person rated 1900 will write to me and say, hey, I'd like to become a national master. Can that be done? Likely, yes. It's not statistically, you know, impossible or improbable, right? It's not saying, can I become a world champion, right? But also that's, you know, a little far. So I would say, you know, maybe a couple of years of work, right? Maybe 15, 20 hours of work a week. You need to play this much, then yes, right? If they ask, can I do this in 2 months, you know, and I have 2 hours a week, okay, probably not. Should you still work on chess? Probably yes, you know, but I think it's important to establish that, right?
Right.
And then, yeah, I think it is important to, from students' perspective, to ask of a coach immediately as much as they can handle, as much as they want, right? Say, hey, can you also, you know, can you suggest me the next book to read? Can you, you know, are you able to provide me the home assignments, right? What else can I do to, you know, make the most of my time on my own, right? And then from a coach's perspective, of course, well, I also want to make sure that the student is, you know, on the same page, right? I mean, they shouldn't ask for home assignments and then they say, hey, have you had a chance to read this? And they say no. And next time, also no. And next time, also no. It's fine if you can't, then you should communicate that. You should say, hey, I'm pretty busy. I'm not sure what my schedule would look like. I'm just looking to get a little better, hopefully, and have some fun in the process. You know, don't establish that kind of expectations, right? And I think, you know, a lot of coaches are also maybe looking for not necessarily a specific type of student, but maybe they prefer working with someone motivated, or they prefer maybe just having fun, you know, and working with someone more casually, right? But I think it's just fair to both to make sure that they're on the same page, understanding what they're doing, when they're planning to get there, what steps are required, and so on, you know?
Yeah, that's great advice. What are some common characteristics of your most successful students?
Yeah, you know, I feel like, to be honest, people who have gone the farthest, I mean, first of all, they just genuinely enjoy learning new things and they have fun, right? They're not putting pressure on themselves. I think if your only objective is, where's my result finally, right? And it's not that fun of an activity for you, it's a little difficult to improve, you know? But what's also interesting is I've had several incredible experiences, which were above and beyond of what I was expecting of that student, where they had very little time, you know, like think someone working 8 hours a week and just doing very little chess, right? Improving tremendously. And what I noticed in every single one of those cases, these people were incredibly good at just following the direction. So, if he has 4 hours for chess a week, he could play 3 games and do some activity or solve some problem I give him, and nothing else, not some useless YouTube videos, not some books that is fun, but not, I mean, literally every single moment is maximized, you know, and these people were incredibly successful in what they did as well in their daily lives for a living. So I feel like when you have a little time, really, you maximize every single bit, then things can go incredibly well, you know. But often, right, if people are more on a kind of casual side, you know, I've been watching this, you know, stream for 6 hours, you know, so it sounds like they're, you know, someone calls it like chess tourists or, you know, chess, whatever it is, you know, and again, it's fun. I'm not against that by any means, you know, but the fact that you're spending a lot of time around the game could be helpful. But if most of it is kind of passive information intake, right, and you're not making decisions, you're not learning how to make decisions, then yeah, it's a little difficult to get better. So I think the key is really, if you have limited time resources, then just maximizing the, you know, every minute, right? Not wasting it. And I think enjoying the process, really, not worrying too much about the results.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I love those two characteristics for being a more successful student. That's great. You know, just kind of get your own personal take on this from your experience as a student, because I've seen you reference online that, you know, you've worked with a lot of coaches over the years and spent many hours receiving coaching. What traits have you appreciated in, you know, the coaches that you've worked with or qualities that they've had that have made it a good experience for you?
You know, it's interesting, actually, because on one hand, I did have a few coaches, but actually, most of it has been very long term. I had a coach, my first coach, for about, I think, a year and a half. And then he just, he was starting out and I was improving a little too fast, which was a good problem to have. And he said that in order to help my growth, he needs to delegate the lessons to his own coach, because he thought he could help me best, which was, of course, an incredible thing to do. And then I worked with that coach for about, I don't know, 4 years maybe. And then I worked with another coach for about 2.5, 3 years. And then I moved to Webster and, well, I worked with Susan Polger here in the Webster team. So really, I could think of 4 or maybe 5 people that I worked with, which is, you know, in an 8 or 9 or 10 year career, it's not that much really, right? Especially given none of this was, you know, because of, say, not enjoying each other, I don't know, having some bad experience, right? It was just, I guess, some, you know, growth stages, right? So I definitely wouldn't say that I worked with 50 coaches, right? Switching some every week, you know? So I guess that's a lot, and what's not a lot can be debated. But generally speaking, yeah, I think, you know, these requirements are also different when you're 1500 or 2400. But I think all of these people already had, you know, first of all, great people. I enjoyed them as people very much. I think that's very important if you spend, you know, dozens of hours talking to someone and learning from them. They had tremendous passion for chess, and I think they just could relate to what problems I was dealing with at the time, right? Because one of my coaches, for example, he was about 2200, and I worked with him until I was somewhat stronger than him chess-wise, and he told me that, you know, hey, I'd love to help you with this, but, you know, we've spent a lot of time discussing how to beat 2000 rated players, but I never play grandmasters. So if you want to play grandmasters, you probably should go to talk to someone who does, right, all the time and learn from them. So I think actually it's interesting. Every single one of my coaches, I think now, has been more interested in my growth and how they can help me the most. They were very altruistic in that sense, right? Not how can I keep the student for the longest, you know, but how can I help them the most, which I think is, you know, a lot of luck on my part, right?
Yeah, well, that's very cool hearing your own experience about that. And I love how you said initially you had a coach that you were improving too quickly for them. I hope one day to have that problem or be able to say that to a coach. I'm improving too fast.
Well, I was his first student and he was 22 at the time and he was just starting. So he thought, yeah, that was the best thing to do. And I greatly appreciate him for doing this. We are great friends right now. And now it's been, 13 years since I've known him.
Very cool. Yuri, all this has been really helpful. I think this is going to give people a lot of insights on how to choose a coach and have a good experience once they do hire somebody. And on that point, I just wanted to ask you about your own coaching that you offer people, because I'm sure a good number of people listening right now are curious as to, you know, how they could work with you if they wanted to. So what's your coaching availability? What options do you have if someone listening to this episode wanted to work with you?
They're very welcome to reach out. I do have some availability now, both for private students. And since last year, I've been experimenting with some group lessons. We had groups from 3 people to 6 people, and it's been super fun. A little bit, of course, different than private lessons, but I think overall a great experience for everyone involved. And I'd absolutely love to help. But I think it's just very important and really great for both parties to establish expectations immediately and make sure that, you know, there is a good fit in this regard. But other than that, I would definitely love to help some ambitious people and some passionate people in the upcoming months.
Yeah, that sounds great. And we'll have links for people who are listening to your website and actually everything else that you have that they can access online as well. More on that later. But if anyone is interested in working with you, we'll have a link to your website so they can go and contact you. I just want to briefly talk about your Chessable coursework, because I know you're always very active with that and doing exciting stuff. Maybe we can just get a little bit of preview of what's upcoming for you. I know you've already put out lots of courses. Again, we'll have a link for people to check out your Chessable courses in the show notes to this episode. But in terms of like what's on the horizon for you, because I know you're always hard at work at that, what's coming up?
Yeah, so actually the next course that's coming will be my 10th course. So that's quite a bit of writing. It's a bit of a writing anniversary. And I'm going to put out a pretty big Twitter post describing some of the, you know, lessons I've taken away from this and experience working with Chessable over the last 5 years.
That'd be great.
Super grateful to all the people involved, both in making courses and in my growth, contributing to my growth with their tremendous advice. But there are 3 courses coming out soon, and I actually haven't published anything since last March, but I've been working on 3 things at a time simultaneously. The very next course that's coming out, which I'm literally recording right now, is a course for Black. It's called the Simplified Black Repertoire, and it'll be everything that Black can face, every single first move based on Queen's Gambit and based on the Scandinavian, which was a bit of an unorthodox choice, and I go in detail explaining why I chose that. And the goal was to make a repertoire that really anyone can learn in a very reasonable amount of time. I think about 100 lines and a ton of model games. Everything my style, everyone familiar with all my courses, that's exactly how I did it, this one as well. And the next course coming out will be the Simplified White Repertoire, doing the exact same thing but for white based on the move 1e4. And there's also a big project coming out, Lifetime Repertoires, the Stonewall Dutch for Black. So that's, of course, a little bit different, a bit of a kind of, you know, heavy hitter, so to speak, heavy weight. Of course, with a lot more variations, but slightly different audience.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm excited to hear about all those Black repertoires that you're working on. And I think some people might know, because I talked about it a lot on this podcast, about the fact that I, for years now, I've been doing your dynamic Italian course, and I absolutely love the Evans Gambit. It's one of the best courses I've ever done. I mean, not just an opening course, but just course period. Your explanations are fantastic. You make it accessible. You make it entertaining, like in the context of chess, you know, like you make it just a very engaging experience to go through. So, I highly recommend your courses to everyone listening. You know, Yuri, just to kind of finish this interview, even though you've been on the podcast twice, I think for about the past year now, I have created like a new closing segment to my show that just has a series of fun questions, kind of like rapid fire fun questions at the end. Okay, first one for you. Who is your favorite player of all time?
That's difficult. That is difficult. Well, probably I would say Kasparov.
Kasparov? Awesome. If you could play a great player of the past who is no longer alive, who would it be?
Maybe Petrosian.
If you could play any of the top players in the world right now, who would it be?
Does Kasparov count, who has been in active careers? I think of course Carlsen.
Awesome. 2 world champs. Love it. These next questions are meant as fun, and it's a little easier for when I ask these for club players if I have an adult improver on the show. But, you know, you've done all these opening courses, so I don't know. Your favorite opening as white?
A little bit difficult. Maybe Catalan.
Okay. Your favorite opening as black?
I'm not sure if I have one, to be honest. It's actually, come to think of it, I do. I think E4, E5, everything E4, E5.
Yeah, I get that a lot from people as a response. They just don't have a favorite opening as black. Okay, so if a chess genie existed and could grant you any one chess wish, what would you wish for?
Well, does it have to be ethical or not? Like, can you say take a move back, you know? But
I guess it doesn't have to be, no.
Well, I guess every chess player needs better calculation skills, right? Myself included. So maybe I would say much better calculation skills, right? Not miscalculate. At least, let's put it this way, not miscalculate in one or two moves ever, you know? If that's doable, then I think, you know, tremendous gains are inevitable at any level. But yeah, if you can go further, since let's say, you know, anytime, you know, you misplace a position, just magically take it back, right, by half an hour or something, you know.
right. Yeah, well, Yuri, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate you coming back to the show for a third time to share all your great insight and wisdom on chess. And I think this will be really helpful for people because, like I said, it's one of the most frequent questions that I'm asked. And now I can point them, I might say a few words in a response to them, but now I can point them to this episode with you where you give tons of great advice on choosing a chess coach and how to make the best of that experience. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
That was a really fun conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of my business, Adult Chess Academy. And that has a website with the same name if you want to look for it. You can also find me being way too active on Twitter by searching my username, Lona_chess. See you next week.